Hi there, I'm Ben Wallace.
And I'm Michael Wong.
And we are Goodness Over God. Well, today we have the special guest, Brian Knapp. He is the founder and contributor of the website choosinghats.com. He's also an editor of the upcoming journal called In Antithesis. He has contributed a chapter on induction, if I'm not mistaken, to a book called The Portable Presuppositionalist, which was edited by Jamin Huebner. And we are just pleased as punch to have him today. Brian, did you want to say a few words about yourself?
Yeah, first of all, thank you both to Ben and Michael for having me on. It's a great pleasure this evening to be able to have a discussion with you. I know you share a passion for things related to religion and philosophy as I do. As you mentioned, I'm the founder and one of the contributors to Choosing Hats, a website that's been around for a little more than 3 years now. We just had our third anniversary just a couple of weeks ago. And our particular website is all about putting forth the presuppositional method of apologetics, which we would say is consistent with that put forward by Cornelius Van Til and by Greg Bahnsen, and what we would call the biblical apologetic method. And so our website is about providing information on that, sharing experience we've had in apologetic discussions with individuals using that method, and that's the purpose for that. And the book you mentioned as well, The Portable Presuppositionalist, is along the same lines. It's talking about different debates that have happened in a presuppositional style, and there are some original essays in there as well that talk about some of the more common themes, morality and logic and induction. And so I guess that would be it for an intro. Thanks again, guys, for having me on tonight.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to have you, Brian. You had a topic for us, right? Would you like to tell us what you'd like to talk about today?
Yeah, actually, just last week or less, I'm trying to remember exactly when we had it, we had, of course, Michael, the debate between you and Chris on the topic, there is a good reason to believe in God or something similar to that. And so it kind of got me to thinking as I was listening back through the debate, what you, the two of you, would consider to be a good reason, because some of the discussion centered on reasoning and induction and deduction, and I know Chris mentioned the transcendental argument as well as some evidential arguments that he put forth from within a Christian worldview. And so as I was listening to that after the fact, it just kind of struck me, and it's a common question for Christians to ask unbelievers, what would it take for you to believe in God? And so I just thought I'd pose that to you two, sort of along the same lines as the topic of the debate. What would you consider to be a good reason, something that would be acceptable, something that you would look at and go, yeah, that seems to work. What would be a good reason to believe in God? And let me just qualify, of course, and I'm not talking about just any God. I think both of you know, with your experience with presuppositionalists, we speak specifically of the Christian God of Scripture. And so to try and focus this in a little bit, what would you take to be a good reason to believe in that God as he is described in the Bible?
Okay. Well, presumably that God is a transcendent God, insofar as if this God exists, he is outside of the universe. He's outside of our experience. He, insofar as he is the author of all of our experiences, all the regularities in particular in our experience, this God would have designed those regularities. It's all his idea, everything that we experience, right? Is that fair to say?
Yes, certainly he is transcendent. We would also argue he's immanent and that he is with us as well as outside of the universe. So okay. Just to make that clarification.
Sure. Okay. I would say that in principle, there can't be any good reason to believe or disbelieve in, assuming we're talking about a coherent idea here. I'm just supposing for a moment that the God, that we have a coherent idea of a God. But setting that aside, that we can't have any good reason to believe or disbelieve or say it's a 50-50 chance or speak at all to whether or not such a thing exists, because we draw inferences about what does and doesn't exist on the basis of our experience. In the world, the regularities of our experience. We build models, and we use those models to predict and control experience. But anything that is outside of those regularities, as something that dictates all of those regularities, would have to be, who isn't subject to any such regularities that we can detect, I don't see how, in principle, we could ever have reason to speak to whether or not such a thing exists. So, you know, now on the other hand, you know, maybe there is some, you know, non-inductive argument, like an ontological argument, that the Christian God exists. I can't imagine what it would be. I'm not familiar with any argument that that works. I mean, so it's like I really can't say. I mean, I'm inclined to say that, as far as I can tell, there just is no reason for anyone, not just me, to believe that the Christian God exists, or to believe that the Christian God doesn't exist. You know, we can't speak to the question. That's what I think.
So you've obviously are familiar with the ontological argument and other classical arguments, I guess, and you don't find them compelling. Is that what you're saying? You don't find that they provide you with what you would consider to be a good reason?
Yeah, I don't think we have good reason to go and take to think that the ontological argument demonstrates that God exists, and Psalms or other versions as well. I don't think they. Yeah, I mean, we can talk about the ontological arguments if you like, or you know.
No, I would agree. They aren't good arguments either. I'm just I'm curious. What I'm pushing for is kind of what's behind the question, and that is, what would you use to determine, you know, what would the criteria be for a good argument, for something that you would find compelling?
Well, go ahead, Ben. I was actually thinking about this before we came on. Of course, maybe I should tell the audience that we had a little bit of email correspondence before this, and so this question came up, and you know, I sent an email to Michael saying that, you know, my first thought is to say that, well, you know, a good reason is going to be something like either, you know, a sound deductive argument, or it's going to be, you know, a cogent inductive argument, you know, or something that can be put into that form. And he replied that he, I think he has the same opinion. He put it in slightly different terms. Instead of framing it as arguments per se, he said, well, you have to be either coherent, right, which is what we mean by deduction, you know, or we have to have some kind of a inductive reach through our through the regularities of our experience. And I tried to come up with some counterexamples to that. And one of the things that I talked about was how maybe little children, you know, they can't go and really articulate or really even understand, you know, how their inductive inferences are working, if indeed they are working at all, with respect to, say, the physical world. So, I don't know, let's just take object permanence, I think was the example that I used. A child comes to understand object permanence at a fairly early age. I'm not entirely convinced that it's through some, you know, reasoned out inductive process. I think that might just be something that naturally happens. And would we want to go and, you know, call that child irrational, you know, because he believes something through some non-explicit inductive argument or something like that, or, you know, not through an explicit inductive argument? And, you know, I don't think so. But then again, I'm not sure it's appropriate to call him rational either. Perhaps he's just, you know, he's just doing what he does. So it's interesting to try to come up with counterexamples. But even if we think we have a counterexample to the coherence or deduction, if you will, and induction, I don't know. All the counterexamples that I was playing with ended up being pretty weak. So, I don't know. It seems like induction and coherence are the two things that we look for. And if we have an inductive inference and a coherent picture, then that seems to be a good reason to believe something.
Yeah, and we don't have, yeah, certainly justification is often, usually comes well after the fact, right? I mean, sure, the child doesn't have a justification for his belief. I would say the child is being non-rational, you know. He's just doing what he's doing. We don't want to discourage that. We can see how he's justified. There is a justification available to him, but even though he doesn't have it. I mean to try to answer your question though, Brian. I mean, if we don't have, and I try to hopefully I was clear as to why I don't think we could have an inductive reason, a reason that's rooted in the idea that there are patterns and we expect those patterns to continue to hold outside of where we observe them. If we can't have an inductive reason, well then I don't think there's going to be any kind of deductive. What are we doing with deduction? I think we're just trying to go and maintain our coherence. I don't think there's any kind of purely deductive argument that can show that anything exists. So I can't see how there's a good reason. Now, of course, we do have just experience. I mean, I don't have an argument that tells me why, to show that I'm having the experience of looking at a mouse right now. I mean, just, which isn't to say I am looking at a mouse, but I'm just talking about that raw experience of looking at a mouse. It doesn't even make sense to talk about justifying it. I mean, if I say I'm looking at a mouse, a mouse experience right now, all I'm doing is I'm assuming that you have a similar model of the world to mine. That you use language in the way that I use language, roughly, and that you had experience as well. That you're another conscious being, and I'm trying, based on all those assumptions, I'm just trying to go and convey to you, something about my consciousness, getting some notion of what's going on in my consciousness over to yours. So, of course, there's no, I don't have a reason there. It isn't applicable, though I do know that I'm having a mouse look, an experience right now that I might characterize as looking at a mouse.
What would you say about a person that holds a belief without a reason? Would you say, like, for instance, you're talking about the young child earlier, and that they weren't, if I remember what you said, that they weren't using reason, or that they weren't being irrational. Maybe they were being irrational without a rational thought process. What about an adult who has the ability to reason and who does that on a fairly regular basis? But I mean, what I hear you saying, the conclusion I would draw is that there are these individuals out there like myself who do believe in God, but according to you, it isn't possible that you know of for there to be a good reason to believe in God. So what would you, and you can just hit me with it, it's okay, I can see the truth, what would you say about individuals who hold that kind of a belief? Are we being irrational? Are we being irrational? Is it some other sort of category?
Well, I would say in the case of God belief that most people are going to be irrational about it. I don't know if it's, maybe it's possible for them to be just sort of naively non-rational, if you know what I mean. It's in the sense that, well, they've just never bothered to think about it. The reason I tend not to emphasize that, though, is because it seems like most people, especially most people who believe in God, do have occasion to go and think about it, right? So their naivety is shattered there. They no longer have the excuse of, well, I just haven't bothered to think about it yet. But for those who have reflected on it, most people I think are going to say that they do have good reason when in fact they don't. And so they're making a mistake, and in the sense that they're making a mistake, well, I think I would call that being irrational. They've made an error of reasoning. For the people, there's some people who, they admit, and I was myself was like this, I didn't have any reason, objective reason to go and suppose that God existed. I just believed by faith. And when I said by faith, I didn't mean, like what William Lane Craig says when he says reasonable faith or something, or maybe what you guys mean when you're talking about, I don't know what you guys talk about when you say faith, but, whatever supernatural stuff is going on there. Yeah, I just meant blind faith. I meant, I just thought the Holy Spirit was working in me to believe, and that I just believed because the Holy Spirit was sort of doing the believing for me. And, you know, I think that that would be irrational as well, because it's a refusal to go and to, you know, give up a belief when we know we have no reason to go believe it. But on the other hand, I think we can come up with some counterexamples, perhaps, to that sort of thing, which gives an interesting question of, you know, why should the counterexamples not be irrational, but that would be irrational. And without getting too far into that topic, Michael suggested that, well, we would want to, you know, we would not want to call things irrational when the belief is something we want to go and sort of maybe propagate or encourage. So, for example, the belief in other minds. Maybe someone, you know, doesn't know any good argument for the existence of other minds, and he just admits, well, hey, I don't believe in the existence of other minds. Excuse me, I don't have a good reason to believe in the existence of other minds, but I'm going to believe anyway because I just feel it in my bones that other minds exist. That sort of willful belief, I think we would want to call that, you know, to not call that irrational, because we want to encourage belief in other minds, because it's so essential for morality, and also because it's so very normal.
I think it's a case of other minds. It's probably mostly non-rational, because not too many people say, hey, why do you believe in other minds? It isn't something that comes up a lot outside of philosophy.
But what if the question, you know, going back to the point, I think, I don't know if it was Ben or you, Michael, that made it earlier about, you know, not everybody takes the opportunity to think about God, but once you do, that naivete is sort of out the window, so to speak. What about the idea of other minds? If you have somebody else who you sit down and talk with and they start to think about the implications and of there being other minds and the fact that they're communicating with you, how could they do that if there wasn't another consciousness there? At that point, if they still are skeptical, not even necessarily refuse outright the existence of other minds, but they're skeptical about whether anyone else exists, any other minds, would you still categorize that as something that was not irrational? Because if I heard you right, because you want to propagate the idea for different reasons, for morality and such, that there are other minds, or once they've had a chance to think through that and evaluate that, does that change their position from being non-rational to something else?
I'm not sure I heard all that question. Are you asking if someone thinks that there is no good reason to believe in other minds and gives up that belief in other minds, then is he irrational in doing that? Is that your question?
Yeah, what I'm doing is trying to find if you are applying the same standard for belief in God as you are in belief in other minds. And what I thought I heard you say was that, well, I'm pretty sure I heard you say that if for those people who believe in a God, you would say they're irrational, but you wouldn't necessarily say that in all cases. And then I thought you went on to give the example of the existence of other minds. You wouldn't necessarily categorize them as irrational.
I would say that somebody who considered, like, gee, do I have good reason to believe that there are other minds, and found they didn't have a good reason, you know, that they didn't have, you know, I mean, if they were in that position and they persisted in going and supposing that other minds existed, that they were being, you know, irrational, because they'd bitten the fruit in some sense. Now, that said, I'm not going to go and start getting on people for believing in other minds, you know, because it's not as if there's any kind of moral consequence, you know, negative moral consequence for believing in other minds per se. Although, if other minds don't exist, I happen to know that other minds do exist, Andy, because at least, insofar as, you know, assuming that you have a mind, I sure know you aren't alone in having a mind. You know, so given that other minds do exist, at least mine, well, yeah, I sure don't want to discourage you from believing in other minds. Although I would go and say, hey, you know, you have good reason to believe in other minds. You know, I mean, I don't mind going and talking about that if the question comes up, but there isn't the kind of moral urgency that there is in the case of God and most other things. And ideally, I do want people to be careful, to develop the epistemic habits of being careful thinkers. So in some sense, believing in other minds, you know, irrationally is a symptom of a bad thing. I mean, you know, that said, yeah, I suppose that if there was this rash of people who didn't believe in other minds and they were being immoral and just behaving in a horrible way, I mean, it may be under circumstances like that we would want to go and discourage people from going and not believing in other minds, even though it was rational to go and doubt it, at least for these people, because they didn't have good reason. Again, I think we do have good reason to believe in other minds, you know, given induction.
So it sounds like what you're about to head into is that you would apply the same standards you talked about earlier as a good reason, a foundation for something you would consider to be a good reason for the existence of God. You would be using that same standard for the existence of other minds. Would that be accurate?
Yes, that's right. I think we
absolutely
have good reason. Yeah, I think we have good reason to believe that other minds exist given induction. I think we do not have good reason to believe that God exists given induction. So there's a difference.
I guess.
And are you going? Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wanted to clarify something real quick. You know, there's a different question, which is, you know, what are we going to call rational versus irrational, which is related to your question, you know, what is a good reason or not. And I was kind of going on about what we should call rational versus irrational. Just because I think it might be irrational or, you know, non-rational or something to go do this, that, or the other, the standard for good reason, I think, is still going to be captured by that induction and coherency, those two criteria.
Okay, so it sounds like you have a standard for determining what's a good reason for belief in God. You have the same standard for determining the existence of other minds. Are you going to be consistent with that standard across the board, regardless of what it is you're talking about? And if you're not, what would be the reason for that?
I'm going to try at least.
Yeah. Of course, you know, hopefully we won't make mistakes, but I always try to be consistent, and I've certainly corrected inconsistencies that I've seen in my own beliefs. And I hope I'll continue to do so. I'm a fallibilist, that's for sure. I know Ben is too.
Yep.
Okay, so would you take into account the nature of what it is you're trying to draw a conclusion about? In other words, you talked about the fact that you can't see there being a good inductive or deductive argument for the existence of God due to the fact that he's transcendent, he's outside of experience, if that's not too much of a leap to say. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me like you're saying that by the nature of who God is, we would not expect to be able to find an argument that was either inductive or deductive. Is that the reason?
Well, I don't know about a deductive argument. It's a different case with deduction. In the case of deduction, I just can't imagine a good deductive argument. And it seems implausible, I guess, but that doesn't go very far. With induction, the case is a little more concrete. Induction works via the regularities of our experience. If God's outside those regularities, induction has nothing to work through in order for us to sort of epistemically get at God. So I don't think there can be a good epistemic reason to believe in God. And I guess I would have to say that I'm agnostic as to whether there's a good deductive reason.
Okay. But I guess the question I'm getting at is, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like one could draw the conclusion from what you're saying that it's due to the attributes of God, how he exists, if he exists, that makes it such that he would escape proof via induction, because induction deals with uniformity and experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you're saying there's something about God that would make it such that he wouldn't be discoverable through uniformity and experience.
Yeah, given the kind of God we're talking about, the author of experience and all the regularities of experience, who is not himself subject to those regularities, I think that, given his nature, given the nature of the thing we're talking about, we can't have reason to suppose that thing exists or doesn't exist, or say what, or speak to the probability of its existence. That is, assuming it's coherent. It may be that the Christian God, as you conceive it, is you don't really have a coherent concept, in which case we can say, okay, well, you aren't talking about anything, Then we'd have to be non-cognitivists with respect to, that notion of God. But assuming we are talking about a coherent idea, then there's no way we can reach that via induction.
Okay. So the standard you're using of induction and deduction, I know you had this discussion with Chris in the debate, and was it Rachel? Is that the name of the gal you spoke with in the other podcast? Okay. I know you spent a significant amount of time, I just listened to that today, talking about induction, and again, not wanting to put words in your mouth, but it sure sounded to me like you said you didn't have justification for that, or justification in the normal sense. Certainly you didn't have a non-circular inductive justification, and you didn't have any deductive justification. So I guess I would ask if, and this is why I asked earlier, if you would be consistent across the board in how you applied what constituted a good reason or not a good reason for the existence of something. How would that differ when it comes to your use of induction? Would you say, given that you don't have either inductive or deductive reasons for believing in the uniformity of nature, would you say that your use of that, your application of it, would be, I'm sure you wouldn't say it's irrational, but would you say it's non-rational, or would you categorize it in some other way?
I think that's very fair to go and say that it is non-rational. But the reason here's the thing, though. What I'm doing, I want to be very careful about this. I'm not saying, oh, look, I have reason to believe that nature will be uniform. No, I recognize that I don't. What I'm doing is I went into this in the debate, certainly on the podcast. I'm going to proceed as if induction is going to be, predictive, as if nature is going to be uniform. What would follow if nature, were to be uniform? I can draw conclusions. It's all contingent, of course. It depends upon, this actually being the case. And then I act as if that were going to be the case. Now, that doesn't involve any kind of self-deception. I don't have to go and pretend that I have knowledge that I don't have, or that I have reasons that I don't have. It's just that, and I don't know if I can recap this if you like. I don't know if you want me to talk about what reason do I have for assuming, for practical purposes, that induction will hold. But it's purely a certain sort of a pragmatic move. I won't even say prudential move, because there's a bit of a distinction there. But it's a certain kind of pragmatic move that I'm making. But again, there's no self-deception. There's no pretending we have reasons we don't have. I have a justification for my actions. I don't have a justification for belief. And even though I may feel that in my bones, I may have a psychological tendency to expect induction to hold, I can kind of reflect on that, and I can kind of smile at myself and say, yep, there I go. I love induction. Not only do I love induction, but I'm just proceeding as if it's natural for me to go and proceed as if induction will hold. I at least up till now, I keep on doing it. I keep on proceeding as if induction will hold.
And is it like a habit that you can't help? Because that's, to me, it's kind of how I hear you describing it when you say something like, well, there I go again, proceeding as if.
We can minimize it, I suppose. I don't think we can cut it out of our lives entirely. In my debate with Chris Bolt, talked about how, you know, even just to reach out and grab a coffee cup, oh, we're using induction there. To be an actor at all in the world, we have to go and use induction. And we can, you know, stop for individual moments and say, well, wait, hold on. I don't have a justification for induction, and so I'm not going to expect the coffee cup to be there when I reach out. But we can't, I don't think we can live our lives that way. I mean, we will never rid ourselves of induction, I don't think.
So far we haven't, anyway. I guess we'll see if that continues the whole of the future, right?
So far, based on your experience, we haven't, right? I mean,
that's right.
I think actually, Ben, you and I talked a little bit after the debate with Chris about this very question, and that is, you know, because what I hear you guys saying is, well, I can't think of any way to evaluate my experience. This is just what we like to do. If I want to be an actor in a robust sense, this is the only way I know how to do it. And so it sounded sort of to me like an argument from, and this is not a pejorative, but just an argument from ignorance. From the standpoint of I can't think of any other way to live my life, and this is what I've done in the past, although that's not really relevant to what I'm about to do right now.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to break in and say it's not an argument from ignorance. It's not as if I'm looking for like the right method, the right strategy. You know, it's not. No, I don't have any reason not to proceed as if induction will hold. It's not as if, I don't want to get the impression it's a bad habit, like a habit that where I say, oh, gee, I wish I could stop doing this. I'm going to try to wean myself off of induction. Because after all, what reason would I have to do that unless there was some other strategy that I thought was better? But it's not as if there's some rival or anything. It's not as if there's some higher standard by which I can say, you shouldn't be doing that, you know? I just try to be transparent and honest to myself and others. I say that I assume, when I'm reflective anyway, I assume that induction will hold. I don't believe it insofar as I don't, in the sense of believing it, that it's not as if I fool myself and think that I have an epistemic justification. But I do for believing, you know, for thinking that it will actually hold. But I do have a good pragmatic reason for proceeding as if it will hold, for assuming for practical purposes that it will hold. Do you see the distinction I'm making there?
Yeah, when you're using, I guess, pragmatic in that sense, are you saying that you have a motivation? Would that be sort of what you're saying? In other words, you're not offering a logical argument or a justification based on logic, you know, with premises leading up to therefore... I should believe that the future is going to be like the past. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you saying you do have that or you don't have that?
Frame it. Well, I would say I can frame it in those terms. It's like it's like this. I have a desire to be an actor in a robust sense. The only way I can be an actor in that robust sense is to proceed as if induction will hold. And so, you know, again, it's normative in that practical sense, you know, for me to go and proceed as if induction will hold. It's not as if I'm just, I mean, granted, if I didn't have that argument about, you know, if I didn't have that, it's really just a feature of induction I'm pointing out and saying, gee, I want to do this. Only induction lets me do it. You could go and just say, well, look, I want to proceed as if induction will hold. There is no argument against me going and proceeding in that way. It's not as if I have a reason not to. So I'm going to do it because, and in doing that, I am doing what I want to do. I have the motivation, but there's nothing irrational about it. That motivation itself is non-rational. All motivations, you know, all basic motivations are non-rational. And that's okay. But I can certainly, you know, construct an argument as to why I should, given my desires, proceed as if induction would hold. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get that. Ben, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I just want to stress, you know, it's not like the conclusion of whatever argument we give for induction isn't going to be something like, therefore, induction will hold. That's not the conclusion that we're trying to reach. We know that there's, well, as far as we know, at least, you know, there's no good reason to, you know, suppose that induction will hold, which is non-circular at any rate. But... the question then becomes, you know, well, ordinarily when we don't have good reason to believe something, you know, we go and we would want to give up those beliefs. So what makes induction so special? You know, why is it the case that we've recognized that, hey, we don't have a good, you know, reason to suppose that induction will hold in a sense of knowledge? We don't have a good reason to, you know, believe that induction will hold, and yet we're still going to go use induction. Why is that? And then we can talk about why we ought to go use induction or why we might want to go use induction, and we can construct arguments along those lines and make observations about why induction is so much more special than other assumptions.
Well said.
So, there's two things that I'm hearing. One is the constant use of the word we. So I'm assuming you're speaking about all humanity when you say things like we're going to go use induction. And
oh no,
this is what we do.
I'm sorry. Sometimes, but just now when I was using the word we, I was using it because I know that Michael and I share the same views on this, or many of the same views at least.
Fair enough. Okay. So it may be the case that other people don't proceed assuming induction.
Mm-hmm. But that's conceivable.
Okay. Well, I mean, just picture somebody, who wakes up and is sitting in the middle of a road, you know, and they're a full-grown adult, and there's a truck barreling down the road at them, and they have a choice to make, and they have very little time to make it, certainly not time to lay out an entire argument. Is that an inductive situation where they're going to say, wow, if I don't roll out of the way, my experience in the past is when I see something coming at me and it hits me, the faster it's coming and the bigger it is, the more it hurts and I better move?
No, that's a really good point. No, and of course we don't operate that way. This is justifications tend to come after the fact. It doesn't make them, you know, it's not to disparage them. We think, okay, did I have good reason to do that? Well, yeah, I've got a model that tells me that this is how I should avoid getting smashed, and I'm going to go and act on that model. Why is that a good model? Well, in the end, if you think about it, the only test for the model relative to my goals is going to be that, you know, that it doesn't end up being, if I want to have a strategy for testing my model, that is, relative to my goals, the only strategy I can use that doesn't end up being incoherent is induction. But of course, when I'm there, and of course, lots of people never think about this, right? People just use models, you know, and they don't have justifications, and you know, that's certainly true.
Yeah. Well, let me change up the analogy then a little bit. Let's say that you're tied to the railroad tracks, and there's a train far off in the distance, and you can hear it coming. And I'm sitting there with you, Michael, and I'm saying, Michael, I'd like you to use your inductive process to decide whether or not you want to try and untie those ropes or not. The point being that it's not so much a flight mechanism or, you know, inherent in my being to try and move out of the way quickly. I'm actually giving you a chance, kind of like we talked about before. Once you've had an opportunity to think through the implications of things, I'm giving you the opportunity in this case to take your time, because you've got a good 4 or 5 minutes before the train arrives. Mm-hmm. I'm giving you the time to evaluate, and I'm assuming that you're going to, at that point, bring induction into the picture, or is that a misrepresentation?
Well, I mean, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, look, I have this physical model of the world, and that model has stood up well over time in getting so far and enabling me to, you know, have the kind of experiences that I want to avoid other experiences. Using that physical model of the world, that, you know, once again, that tells me I need to go and untie these ropes, right, if I don't want to get squashed. So the model itself is, you know, has borne up against induction, you know, at least better than any other, you know, alternative model I might imagine. Like the model of sitting there and, this is just like a strategy of sitting there and just wishing that the ropes would disappear and that I would disappear. That's not part of my physical model of the world says that's not going to go and do any good, and I'm not going to escape the train that way. It's another way I could proceed, but that's not the model that stood up. Wishing for
right, and you're just kind of thinking back to what you said earlier. The reason you would continue to apply the model is because you have no reason not to.
Well, the reason I have. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the reason that we apply the model, at least the physical model, is because it's just, that's just the way we think. I don't know how to make sense of the world without my physical model. This is just what I do. I suppose it's conceivable that I could go and break myself of this, and I could escape my physical model of the world, and I could just, you know, think in other terms. But I sure don't know how. I'm just stuck here, you know.
Well, I can imagine doing it. I mean, I can click my heels together and say, I wish I were home. I wish I were home. Or I want to go home. I want to go home and hope that I disappeared away from the train. But that doesn't bear up very well. You know what I mean? Given my experience with the way the world works, that's a different model of the way the world works. It's maybe not completely different, but it's different enough that I don't want to use that model. So that doesn't, you're right. I'm not going to think through this generally. I'm just keep on.
Right. But if I've given you the time to think through it and I'm asking you to think through it, then you certainly have the opportunity. I guess what I'm hearing is anytime you're making this decision to follow a model or not, you're appealing back to past experience, which I think is where problem of induction standpoint, it just sounds to me like you're doing the very thing that you're appealing to induction even as a basis for your pragmatic choice to continue to use induction.
Please understand the pragmatic choice. First of all, it's like the pragmatic choice in question is that my decision to be that I want to be an actor in the world, right? That's the justification I have. If I'm going to be an actor in the world, then I have reason to go and use models that stood up to it in the inductive test. I'm not saying that, like, well, gee, given that I don't want to be hit by a train, I have reason to use the inductive. I have reason to use induction.
Why would you say that? Why would you say that in order to be an actor in the world, you need to use induction?
Well, again, in that certain robust sense, if I want to go, and you know, this is where I talk about how, you know, you have models that can you have strategies that can evaluate other strategies, you know, and relative to their goals. There are lots of models that we have that aren't going to do that. There are lots of strategies we have that aren't going to be able to be meta-strategies. They aren't going to keep scaling, not saying, well, was that a good strategy relative to our goals. Induction is different. Induction can do that and be coherent. Other models can do it, but they end up being at least potentially inconsistent, if they work. Like counter-induction, for instance, if I go and I say I'm always going to do things that haven't worked before, well, if I do something that works, if that strategy works, then I have to abandon it, you know? This is just a feature of induction that makes induction special. It's like this global strategy. That doesn't mean that, you know, somebody who rejects it is being incoherent or anything. Or, I mean, in the end, it's like, look, I want that kind of strategy. That's the bottom line. And you know, if in fact induction is going to be predictive, if in fact the world is going to be regular in this way, well, then that's going to protect me from the train, and other strategies won't. You know, but that's a big if. That if itself is, I have to acknowledge, ultimately, I don't have any justification for supposing that in fact this is the model that's going to work if I don't assume induction to begin with. You see what I'm saying?
Sure, I guess maybe there's a couple of things that I'm not understanding. One of them being an actor in the robust sense, and I guess, I mean, I think I have an idea of what you mean, but maybe you could, you know, clarify that a little bit. And then the other thing you said, it allows you to evaluate and scale up. I'm definitely, I don't think, following what you mean by that. Maybe you can give me an example.
Sure. It's like this. Suppose I here I have my, let's see, let me think of an example. Suppose I'm going and I'm playing a game with some dice, and I go and I can, you know, I'm going to go and win the game if I get in, you know, if I get snake eyes, right? And I need to know whether or not it, you know, how much should I bet for the game? You know, how should I proceed? How should I gamble? And it's like, well, I can go and, you know, and say, well, gee, given the way dice are, given the way, you know, given the way this particular random number generator worked in the past, it's going to, you know, I should go and, you know, bet in this way. But then I can go and test it. I can go and see if it works. Suppose that I keep on losing. It never comes up snake eyes. After 100 tries, it never, you know, comes up snake eyes. Well, then I can go and say, you know, that strategy that I had, which was based upon, you know, my, you know, which is based upon this model, you know, well, it turns out it's not holding up. So I can say, I better go and try a different strategy. I better go and abandon this inductive strategy because it's you know, based upon my previous knowledge about the way dice works and so on, because it turns out that in this case, when I'm playing this game, it's not working anymore. So maybe I need to go and find another model. I mean, induction can tell me to abandon what was a model that stood up to induction. It can go and tell me to go and switch it up. I mean, for instance, suppose every time I go and I do something that you know, the induction tells me that I should do, suppose I end up going and failing, you know? So suppose I bet on the way dice work and the way that dice have rolled in the past, and I end up going and losing consistently. Well, I can go and adopt the strategy of switching it up, of going and not going with what worked before. And if that starts working, if my counterinductive strategy starts working, well, then on a higher level, induction tells me I should continue to use that counterinductive strategy. So you see, there's a scale there. We can evaluate, you know, a strategy on one level, on a higher level, to say, is this strategy a good strategy? And we can keep going up. You know, we can keep, you know, it's like in the end, what we're concerned with are results, the results in the past, you know? And we can keep on taking on new information and abandoning existing strategies, even though they work and were recommended to us by induction. There's no other strategy that can be self-correcting in that way on different levels. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, how about the strategy where I think and it happens?
Where I think it happens. Okay, well, here's the thing. That's not a strategy. You can't evaluate other strategies relative to goals. And again, this is always relative to goals, right? You can always go and have a strategy where you just approve everything. You can say, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good strategy. Yeah, that's a good strategy. But that's not relative to the goal that you have in mind, right? I want to win money or whatever if I'm playing my dice game. You know, there's something that I want to achieve. And just the strategy of like, well, I'll just think about what I want and it'll happen. Well, there's no way for that to scale up. I can't go and it doesn't even make any sense. I can't coherently formulate what it would be like to evaluate the strategy I think and it'll happen in accordance with the strategy I think and then it'll happen. You know, I don't even know how to approach that.
Is there a need to evaluate it, really?
Oh, look, no. You could coherently not do that. No, indeed. Look, this is the point. Yeah, it's not as if somebody is being incoherent if they go with I'm just going to do whatever I feel like strategy. People can do that, but most of us eventually anyway end up turning to induction. I mean, you know, we may, and not that people don't make mistakes, obviously they do, and relative to induction, but look, yeah, people can do that, and the whole point is that we don't have any way of criticizing people who aren't using induction or aren't using induction consistently outside of the umbrella of induction, right? We depend upon induction to go and criticize people and say, oh, that's a bad strategy. And in the end, we have to appeal to our desire to use induction. That's the dilemma. That's the dilemma that Hume pointed out. I don't think there's any escaping it. I'm just trying to acknowledge it and say, nevertheless, I'm going to use induction. It has these features that I find to be really attractive. And heck, even if it didn't have those features, you know, if I never identified that, I just want to use induction. And there's no criticism for that. It's not as if you can say that's a dumb idea. I mean, why not? You don't have, you know, it's not as if, you know, there's something that I'm missing. I'm not being incoherent if I use induction, you know, so that's what I'm going to use, you see? I'll tell you, if I could just ask this, I mean, I may want to comment on that. I don't see how anyone has anything else. I mean, it's not as if, like, bringing God into it, for instance, changes the situation. This is something I tried to go and point out in the debate. How do you think God puts you in a different position than anyone else is in?
That's a very valid question. let me do this, because I definitely want, I had a couple more questions, but I'll gladly jump into.
Well, sure. Why don't you ask the other questions first, and then we can put the heat on you after that.
Yeah, it's only fair. It's only fair. So I thought, Michael, I heard you say that you can't really criticize somebody for not using induction unless you have induction. Is that right?
Yeah. Outside of the that umbrella of induction, as I like to say.
So why can't I criticize you for using it? Let's say that I'm a person who chooses not to use induction, and you're a person who chooses to use it. And on what basis, what standard are you applying to say that you can or cannot criticize? And I'm sure you're not just saying you can't utter the words "you're a fool" or you can't utter a criticism. It sounds to me like there's something more behind your phrase "you can't criticize them."
Oh, yeah, I'm being coherent. Yeah, go ahead, Ren Ben.
You can go and you can say, "Well, look, I don't like the fact that you're using induction." Or maybe you could say it a little more qualitatively. You could say, "I don't like the fact that you're using induction without a reason. So I don't think you should go use induction without a reason. If you don't have a reason, you should stop using induction." You could say, something along those lines. Or you could just say, "Hey, I don't like induction, so please don't use induction."
But how is that different, though, from your criticism of me as a non-induction user?
I just want to say, just for the sake of completion, really quickly, you may have something like a non-inductive strategy, and you could criticize me for using induction underneath the umbrella of your non-inductive strategy. I mean, too, right? And the thing is, the whole point is that there's no, if we aren't don't agree on induction, all we can do is say, well, are you being coherent or not? You know, I mean, otherwise, we're going to have to go underneath our own umbrellas and criticize from underneath that umbrella. But, you know, the only common ground we have is coherence. So, yeah, in the end, I guess we can criticize each other all we like, but, you know, given that the other person doesn't share our inductive assumption or this particular non-inductive assumption that serves that role as being a general strategy for acting in the world, there's just, you know, we're just talking at cross purposes. That's just maybe it's unfortunate, I don't know, but that's just the position we would be in. That doesn't mean that what we're doing is incoherent just because we can't criticize people who reject that particular strategy, and they can't criticize us, you know, except for underneath our own umbrellas. And again, we can still all criticize those who are being incoherent.
Okay, because I thought I heard you say one of the reasons you use induction is because it's the strategy for evaluating strategies, and it gives you the ability to criticize. But yet, are you now saying that I, as a non-inductive user, I would also have the ability to criticize? In other words, I want to make sure I'm using the word ability in the same sense that you're using it. Because it seems to me like a minute ago you said, I use it because it gives me this ability and I don't know of any other way to do it. But yet, now it seems like you're saying, well, Brian, you could criticize me under your umbrella, which means that my particular approach would give me the ability, in quotes, to criticize you as well.
Well, you can criticize me and you can say, hey, you're using induction. My strategy says don't use induction. You know, and there you are. You know, yeah, and I can say, oh, sure enough, given the strategy that you're using, it tells me I shouldn't use induction. So, you know, given your standard there that you're using, then yeah, shame on me, I guess. But then I can say, I don't really care about your standard. I'm using induction. And you can say, I don't care about your standard. I'm using this non-inductive standard. And there
right.
we go. You know what I mean? That's
right.
The position that we're in. Luckily, though, again, using induction, you know what I mean? I found so far, at least, that most people do go and hold themselves accountable to induction. So I don't have that. Doesn't come up too much. You know, it's never come up actually for me so far.
Right, but it may at any moment, obviously, because we're always when we're talking about induction, we're always talking about what we have yet to experience, right? From the standpoint of trying to solve this problem that's out there.
Sure.
So okay. So Ben.
Yes.
Go ahead. I'm under the spotlight now. It's only fair.
it's like we said. I don't know any how theism is going to help the situation. I guess one of the things that that you and Chris and other presuppositionalists have really emphasized is that, you know, you've got the problem solved under Christian theism. And I just don't see how. I mean, presumably you want to say something along the lines of that, you know, the Christian God has gone and ensured that, you know, the future is going to be like the past. I wonder, and we haven't covered this before, I wonder if your eschatology is going to throw a wrench in that, because don't you believe that, and I don't know, this, I almost don't want to get on this because it is kind of a tangent, but I was thinking, you know, if you think that the Christian God is going to come back at any moment, no one knows the day or the hour, and everything's going to change then, well, if you don't know when that's going to happen, well, how do you really know that the future is going to be like the past, that those regularities are going to hold? But beyond that, though, I mean, even just ignoring that problem, it seems like any causal story that you tell between the Christian God and the future, you know, here God has willed that the universe is going to be like this and, you know, the other, and it's just going to continue to be so because, well, I suppose induction is going to tell you that God's will is going to continue to align to reality. But then you would be having some kind of a circular reason. The alternative to that would just be to say, well, I'm going to lump in the assumption that, you know, that the future is going to continue to resemble God's will, in which you're just sort of lumping induction along with, lumping a whole bunch of other assumptions along with induction. So in one case, it seems to be circular. If you avoid the circularity, then you just have to take it as an assumption along with all the theism stuff. I don't see how induction follows somehow from theism, though, or from Christian theism. It's only going to follow if you already have it packaged up with theism. I don't see how it's going to, you know, how you can get it any other way.
Okay. Well, let me throw something else in the mix. You don't even have to look into the future for the question of eschatology. You can look at miracles in the past, right? Obviously, as a Christian, I believe in the Bible, and there are examples of what we would call, in a sense, deviations from uniformity in nature. So here I am giving you more bullets to shoot me with. essentially... we do not claim that we know that the future will always be like the past. The question is, are we justified in proceeding as if it will be? In other words, on what basis does a Christian believe that the future is going to be like the past? It's not a claim to know with certainty that it will be all of the time. And something that folds into this is the entirety of the Christian worldview. So I think, if I understood you properly, I think it would be closer to the second option you gave, where we're lumping all of Christian theism in as those things that we're assuming. So we're assuming God's revelation to us is true. We're assuming that, like Scripture says, God is not a liar. So when God tells us that the story found in Scripture, that season will follow season, and God has created this world for us to learn about Him so we can glorify Him, and so on and so forth, we could go through all the Scripture that a presuppositionalist would use to outline their case for induction. What we find there is a story that's told that says, look, yeah, there is a day coming when things are going to change. And there are examples in the past, depending on how you would choose to define miracle. There are examples in the past where, you know, we were certainly surprised by something that happened. There's example after example. In fact, the whole reason a miracle has the impression it has is because they don't happen all the time, or it wouldn't be an outstanding extraordinary kind of event. So So they have their impact, and they serve the purpose that God intended them to serve just because nature is generally uniform. So all of those things working together, we would say, give us a reason to believe that is, we should proceed as if nature is going to be uniform, continue to be uniform. So I guess my point there would be that, you know, we start with the presupposition that Christian theism is true. Given that set of presuppositions, we have a non-circular, what I would call transcendental justification for proceeding as if the future is to be like the past, along with a whole host of other things. In fact, the larger claim of the transcendental argument is you can't make sense, you can't make intelligible anything at all, and that would be the fact that we do proceed as if the future will be like the past. Moral decisions, use of logic, those are the big three that are typically used, but it can be anything at all. So I don't know if the issue that you have is that if the Christian worldview were true, it still wouldn't solve the problem, or that it's only moving the problem back a level by saying, or maybe you see both of those as problems. I'm not sure.
Well, it just seems like when you say that you're assuming all this stuff, you know, it's, mm-hmm. I mean, sure, you can package it together and call it Christian theism, but I mean, there doesn't seem, if you go and you show, look, we can't live without the assumption of induction. We can't go and be, you know, consistent or whatever without the assumption of induction. But why does it have to be that package or nothing? You know, the package doesn't add anything to the assumption of induction. Here we have the assumption of induction, and that's great. You know, we all assume that induction will hold. We all act as if induction is going to hold. Like I said, that's great. That's all well and good. But why, you know, if that's the assumption that we need, if that's what we need to, you know, make our experiences intelligible, or to be an actor in the world, or to do whatever we need to go do, why not just leave it at that? It just doesn't seem like induction is... I guess you sort of acknowledge that induction doesn't follow from the existence of God. We need it alongside. We need it in the package along with God, right? So it seems like you agree with me there.
No. What I'm not saying is that... from my perspective as a Christian theist, that I believe everything in the Bible, I assume everything in the Bible is true, plus I also assume induction is true. What I'm saying is, based on what I assume in the Bible, I have reason to believe that the future will be like the past. So it's not a presupposition based on nothing. It is a conclusion I draw based on what has been revealed to me in Scripture. So that's the first distinction, I would say, between your assuming induction and my concluding induction based on what I find in Scripture.
Are you saying it's more like you're sort of, you have this outline of a story for the, you know, how the world is going to go, and, you know, part of the story is that, you know, God's going to do all these things. He's going to, you know, live on for eternity, and he's going to separate the wheat from the chaff and all that, right? And, you know, that story only makes sense if induction holds. Is that kind of where, what you're saying?
Well, without getting into an argument for the package deal itself, what I would say is, just hypothetically, if we take Christian theism as a package, it gives us a reason that is not circular, and more importantly, non-arbitrary, to believe, to justify our belief that the future will be like the past. And the non-arbitrary point is very important, which is really, I guess, the whole reason behind the very question I started us off with, and what would you consider to be a good reason? Because if the Bible was silent about the world around us, And that was not part of the revelation. And there wasn't a talk of a God who created both the subjects and objects of knowledge. There wasn't discussion about his sovereignty in keeping, holding the world in his hand and moving and breathing and living in him, as it says in Acts. And there wasn't this underlying purpose that the reason God has done all of this is so that we may learn about his creation and therefore learn something about him, and ultimately he is glorified by that. If you didn't have, if you want to use the term story, sure, if you didn't have all of that there, or should I say, when you have all of that there, if it were true, it would be a reason to go ahead and proceed as if the future is going to be like the past. If we look back at it and we say, yes, I believe that God never lies. Yes, I believe he's the creator. Yes, I believe he's sovereign. Yes, I believe he wants me to learn about his world. Yes, I believe it's for his glory. All of those things together are a story that is consistent and cogent and gives me a reason to say, hey, okay, then this thing that I just find myself doing, and by the way, I'm not a non-inductivist, okay? I'm not suggesting that we give up induction either. I hope you see that. It's more about what's the reason for doing it and going back in hindsight and saying, yes, I am justified in continuing on and doing this and in seeing what's happened in the past and applying it to the future. And it's just because I live in God's world. It's just because I can be confident that he's created this universe in such a way that it will continue to operate in such a way that I can learn more about him, and I can bring glory to him by doing that.
But Brian, when you say God is sovereign, aren't
yes.
you saying that whatever God wants happens? Isn't that pretty much what you're saying, or is there something else to saying that God is sovereign?
To say that God is sovereign means that he is in control. So certainly his will, mm-hmm. his will of decree, as I would call it, is definitely part of that. In other words, God's actions, like our actions, mm-hmm. I would say are based on who we are and what we want to do. So yes.
Okay.
I think that's fair.
So God wants, for the most part, God wants induction to hold, and you're saying whatever God wants is going to happen. And so induction is going to hold. I don't see how that's any better than just saying, use my example of an eye rock, for instance. First of all, you know, from the debate where I say, look, suppose there's this transcendental rock that, and it just has this feature where it causes our universe to be regular. Well, given that the eye rock is, has these causal powers, that it has this causal effect on our universe, then our universe is going to go and have these regularities. I mean, I'm not really adding anything when I posit an eye rock, just like I'm not adding anything when I posit like an eye universe, where we just say the universe is such that nature is going to be consistent. I can say, okay, well, given that it's an eye universe, it follows that induction is going to it's going to be a good guide to what's going to happen. I mean, I don't see how you're doing any better than that.
Well, help me understand here a little bit, maybe the eye universe a little bit better. Are you saying that that's just the way the eye universe is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, an eye universe is just a universe where, induction is going to be, useful and predictive because the eye universe is going to be regular in a relevant way.
So that's sort of just labeling what you already believe, right? I mean, you act as if the universe is going to be regular.
Well, yeah, I would say I assume an eye universe. I don't believe in it insofar as I don't fool myself into thinking that I have an epistemic justification for thinking that, yeah, the universe is going to be regular. I don't think it seems like we're in the same boat there, that what you're adding, when you say, well, there's this being that wants this to happen and everything it wants comes true. So so therefore things are going to go this way. Okay, yeah, if you just stipulate that everything he wants is going to happen, then I guess that'll happen, but you don't need God. You could just, why not just stipulate the universe is going to be consistent? I don't see how you've added anything by saying there's a God, he wills things, and whatever he wills comes true. You see, I don't, what do you think you're getting out of that?
Well, I'm getting a reason to believe that the universe is uniform, whereas you're starting with the belief that the universe is uniform, that nature is uniform. I think it's coming back to me trying to understand what you mean by I universe. If an I universe just is a universe where induction holds, then you haven't gained anything with that, and that is not analogous to what I'm saying with God. In other words, God is a God created the universe. He's a personal being. He is ensuring it. In other words, it's through God that the universe is continuing to operate in such a way that we can use induction
through God's causal powers. Right?
I don't know how God does it. I wouldn't use the term causal powers because, you know, Scripture doesn't tell me that. You know, the closest thing that Scripture tells me is that he speaks. You know, the universe came into existence because he spoke. So he does. It doesn't go into the mechanics, is what I'm saying.
Well, it's not the mechanics that we're after. I mean, just to go along with the example you gave, God speaks and the world comes into existence. There's one story where, you know, here's God, he speaks, let there be light, and then there is light, right? And the assumption is, well, it's, as you said, because God spoke, you know. But then there's also maybe a world where that we can conceive where God speaks, let there be light, and oh, there just happens to be light. There's no causal connection there. I mean, presumably you want to say it's not just happenstance. It's not just that, you know, here's God willing things, here's things happening, and wouldn't you know, they just line up. No, it's because God wills things that they happen, right?
Sure. Yeah, it's not, my point is it's not, God is transcendent, and so I don't know specifically how he does. I don't know how his speaking causes it to happen. Maybe his speaking is an anthropomorphism for what's going on, so that I can better understand. I don't know the details. Is what I'm saying, but I understand what you're saying. It's the concept of God as a cause, right? I mean, that
right?
I mean,
what you're, because if you're saying that God is a cause, then it seems I don't see how that makes sense apart from a context of regularities where we're going and you know, saying through those regularities that, oh, here's a regularity of God causing things, and by induction we infer that, you know, he's going to cause, other things he wills are also going to happen. Without the regularities, I don't see how to make sense of that causal story.
Sure, it's a difference in what I'm appealing to. That's why. It's what I'm appealing to is God himself and the truth of his word and his nature. I'm not appealing to the fact that because when God spoke in the past, something happened, that him speaking again in the future will happen as well. In other words, I'm not looking at my experience in the past and saying, you know, every time God has commanded something would happen in the past, it's happened in the past, and therefore, because the future is like the past, God's commanding in the future will also result in whatever. No, I'm just, it just is a fact that when God commands, regardless of whether it was the past or the present or the future, the result will be whatever God says.
Why not just say, you know, the IROC rumbles, and because the IROC rumbles, the universe is as it is.
Okay.
How does that add anything at all? I don't see how that's any different than saying God spoke, and because God spoke, the universe is as it is. I realize you aren't making an inductive argument yourself, but what you're doing is you're supposing that there is a relationship, a correspondence. One thing happens, and another thing happens, you know? Mm-hmm. God wills X, Y, and Z. Lo and behold, we have X, Y, and Z. Well, the IROC can go and, you know, rumble the way it rumbles, and because it rumbles the way it rumbles, you know, we can say just X, Y, and Z, you know?
Okay, sure.
You know, it's like you aren't...
No, I understand. I think I understand. Mm-hmm. where you're going with this. You're hypothesizing something that is analogous to a piece of God, right? In other words, the only thing we can only talk about one thing at a time, and what we're talking about is induction. So it sounds like you're saying, well, why not posit this other thing called the IROC that basically does the same thing God does from the standpoint of making nature uniform? Is that what you're saying? And why God and not the IROC?
I mean, if you like, we can go and expand the IROC's role. We can go and also have it, you know, not just regulate, but, you know, create the universe. We can have, I mean, I don't think it makes any sense. I don't think it's incoherent to say that it creates logic. But if we could say that, we could say that it creates logic, that it creates morality, whatever you want. We can just say that it just does that. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, you know, but it's not conscious, you know, because it seems to me that the central thing is you want to say that a conscious being wanted all these things. And lo and behold, there they are, you know, and that's why. Why bring consciousness into it? That's really what I want to know. Why?
I see. So your purpose in calling it an IROC instead of an I person or an I being, I guess, is because you're purposely making it non-conscious, right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Well, just real briefly, what it sounded to me like you were doing, where you were saying, you know, we can say that it creates morality and it creates logic, even though you would have a concern with that. It sounds like you were attempting to make the IROC more and more like God, with the exception of consciousness. Is that accurate? Is that the direction you were going to say if we wanted to expand it more, we could have it include all these other things that, Brian, you say God is doing?
Well, all we need, I think, are the IROC to produce, or to cause, if you will, are those parts of our experience that you want God to explain. We don't have to have it do anything that God does off by himself. All it has to do is, you know, do whatever explanatory work you want God to do for our experiences.
That's right. It plays that role. It doesn't need to play any other role.
Right. So it would need to explain everything then, basically. Because that's my claim about God, is he explains everything. And any of my experiences are intelligible only because God exists as he exists. So I would, my point being, I would be, and maybe we save this for a second discussion, I don't know, but my point is that what you're heading toward is making something more and more like God until you're just calling it something different. And what might be beneficial is to say and discuss, well, why is consciousness, you know, important? Why can't it be an unconscious, non-personal being? Why is sovereignty important? Why, and, you know, I can certainly share my belief as to why those things are relevant to the overarching picture, but it's an entire set of presuppositions.
Yeah.
It's not, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, and that is a good discussion to have, talk about what's so special about consciousness. I would hesitate to add, though, that Ben and I don't think we need an IROC. You know, we don't think that it even makes sense to speak about causality and properly the way. I mean, we've talked about a causality, too, on several podcasts, and we probably have a different conception of it, or we have a conception of causality. We don't understand what other conception, you know, what other sort of conception there could be. And it doesn't make any sense to say that, from our point of view, that we need something that transcends our experience to cause us to have, you know, this experience or that experience. So just to be clear, we don't think there is something out there, but it just isn't conscious. But assuming there were something out there, we can always ask, which, you know, could be, we can still ask, well, why suppose it's conscious?
I understand. But trying to understand why you posited it then, so you're saying you don't think an IROC gains you anything?
Yeah. Well, an IROC is just as arbitrary as as a God. There's no reason to posit either one. But I don't see any merit of a conscious being over a non-conscious being in this transcendent realm, you know, making it the case that the universe is the way it is.
I mean, it's kind of tough because there are, I for one have lots of different concerns with the presuppositionalist case for God, and, you know, I've stressed different ones at different times. Here's one particular concern about the IROC. It's, you know, granting that we're going to have some external agent, you know, playing a causal role, why is consciousness special? There are other emphases that we could, or there are other criticisms that we could talk about and have talked about. I talked about one of my favorite, I guess, is you know, if you want to just play the assumption card and say, well, we're going to assume this and that and the other, you know, well, there's lots of things that's not a lot different actually from what we do with induction. You know, why can't we just assume induction the way that we've assumed it and just leave it at that, and then, you know, go on and assume whatever else we need to assume as it comes. That's one criticism to take. I guess Michael probably prefers the IROC criticism. The external criticism that we focused on here.
Sure. Well, I think there's benefit to having further discussion on that, especially your concern about all the assumptions. You know, assumptions, presuppositions, basic beliefs, or whatever, are a very foundational part of this particular apologetic method. And could easily spend an hour and a half developing that idea alone. And maybe that would be the next thing to talk about, because it really is foundational to why a presuppositionalist argues the way they do. And a lot of the criticisms that come out, some which you've shared, others which you haven't, are answered based on the starting point of, you know, there is no neutrality, there are no group facts, everybody has presuppositions, God hasn't made us in such a way that we just know things on our own. We're not autonomous. We're not our own standard, et cetera, et cetera. So there are foundational things, I think, that if they were discussed, perhaps in this venue, might answer further questions.
Well, that sounds like fun, Brian. I enjoyed another
podcast. Yeah. And by the way, I didn't, of course, I absolutely agree with you that we can only talk about one thing at a time. And so I'm almost sorry to have brought up that other thing.
No.
I don't want to feel like I'm like pummeling you with you know, what about this? What about this? No, Leslie, we can focus on, on the IROC.
No, I honestly feel like I've had more of an opportunity to question and grill you guys this evening. So don't feel bad at all. I think it's been a great discussion.
Oh, well, good.
It's been a lot of fun. It's been very pleasant talking to you, Brian. Thank you very much for your time this evening.
Okay, thanks.
It sure has been great. And why don't you? I need to make a couple quick announcements, and then Brian, maybe you can actually. Would you like to close, Brian? After
sure.
I finish with
yeah.
the. Okay. My announcements are as follows. First of all, and maybe we probably should have given these at the beginning of the podcast, but oh well, that's how it goes. As we alluded to throughout the podcast, Michael did indeed have his debate with Chris Bolt, and you can download that at goodnessovergod.blogspot.com. It was generously recorded, uploaded, moderated by the one and only Brian Knapp right here with us today. So thank you very much for making that possible, Brian. I thought the debate was fantastic, so I encourage everyone to go out and listen to that. It's also available at Brian's website, choosinghats.com. So if you'd like to visit that website, you can do so as well and download it there, or you can even stream it directly from there, I believe. I wanted to say something about having guests. We are always on the lookout for guests. We enjoy conversations that are insightful and stimulating, polite, but we do enjoy a little bit of aggression. We want you to disagree with us. So if you're out there, you're listening to us, and you think that we've just lost our minds, then by all means, go and email us at goodnessovergod@gmail.com and go ahead and drop us a line there. Tell us why you'd like to be on the podcast, what you'd like to talk about, and all that good stuff, who you are, yada yada. Let's see. You can also post a comment requesting to be a guest in the blog. Excuse me, on the show on our blog, goodnessovergod.blogspot.com. So that about wraps up the announcements, and I want to say again, it's been a great pleasure to have Brian on tonight. My enthusiasm hasn't showed quite as much tonight because I tell you, it's just been busy for me. School has started back up, so I apologize if I sounded a little tired today. But to be sure, it has been a great pleasure, and I was very excited to have you on. It's just been a great experience. So why don't you go ahead and say a few closing words and lead us out.
Great. Yeah, I'll just restate what was said at the opening. ChoosingHats.com is our website. You can also get the debate there along with interact with us in our chat room. If you go to the, I'm just pulling up the site here, I'm sure that the tab is just called chat. And yes, it is. If you just click on the chat tab, you'll find that we typically don't get into discussions even of the nature that we had tonight. It can turn into debate in our in comments on our posts, just because it's a difficult thing for us to always get back within a reasonable amount of time and respond, and we have different people who respond. And so what we encourage people to do, if you want to have an interactive discussion with us regarding, you know, what we've talked about tonight here or just presuppositional in general, certainly come into our chat room. That's the reason that it's there. It's an IRC room, and we would love to have you there. Ben and Michael, thank you so much for having me on, and you were very gracious. Didn't feel like I was under the spotlight at all. It was just a great conversation, just like we were sitting together at a table sharing some coffee or your beverage of choice, I guess. So with that, thanks again, and I look forward to chatting with you guys again.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
Good night.